This verse deals with the fact that all unbelievers, whether they know it or not, reside under a state of God's wrath. And again, the Jews certainly were. They were largely in unbelief. But John 3:36, he who believes in the Son has eternal life, present possession and abiding possession. Once you get saved, you have a home in heaven you cannot lose, you cannot change it, you cannot foul it up. That's good news. That's the best news, is that you don't have to worry about that. But he who does not obey the Son will not see life, but the wrath of God abides on him. And then, of course, Romans 1:18 talks about wrath upon people. And God has not, obviously, has withheld his wrath at some major points. Otherwise, the human race would have been destroyed by now. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all unrighteousness, or all ungodliness, and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. It's bad enough to not be positive, to not be interested in the truth. It's quite another thing to actively be working against the truth. And that God will bring on their head at some point. Okay, well, moving on now here to verse 12. Again, answering, Pilate said to them, "What shall I do with him you call King of the Jews?" And here Pilate makes it very plain when he says in his previous question, "Do you want me to release for you the King of the Jews?" It's not because he believes it. He's just using the title as they've used it. Again, you've got a mild adversative here, but or now. Again, to show a contrast, it's not translated. But there's a contrast in the Greek between Pilate and these chief priests. And now a contrast between Pilate and the crowds. Again, Pilate, Pilatos, his proper name. Again, adverb Pauline, P-A-L-I-N. Pilate, having responded, aorist deponent participle of apokrinomai. The verb means to judge from, again, to make a determination mentally before you speak. Having mentally assessed the situation, he was saying, or kept saying, or repeatedly asked. Them would be, in this context, those in the crowd. The last referent we have here is the chief priest stirred up the crowd to ask. And so the them here likely refers back to the crowd. What, therefore, or what then, you have an interrogative pronoun tis, with the inferential conjunction noon. Okay, therefore, based on all that you're saying here now, since you're hollering for Barabbas, what shall I do with him you call the King of the Jews? What, therefore, do you wish or want? Again, the word fellow here, the word is textually suspect, but it doesn't add or change anything, whether it's there or not. We get the gist of this. Literally, what should I do? You got poieo in the subjunctive mood. What should I do? Whether fellow's there or not really, again, is irrelevant. What do you want me to do is not very much different than what will I do, or what do you think I should do? With whom? Whom? With him, actually. Whom? And that's the relative pronoun host. Whom you call. Again, this phrase is textually suspect as well, but doesn't really do anything to change the meaning, whether it's here or not. That you call the King of the Jews, that you say is the King of the Jews. But I think it's probably there. I think it was probably original. So I've left it here in the notes. Again, whether it is or whether it isn't does not affect the meaning of the sentence. What he's asking them is, now that you say you want Barabbas set free, well, what am I to do with Jesus, is the gist of it. That's all he's asking. Who you call the King, Basileus, of the Jews. This is an objective genitive. When you get these phrases like this, King of somebody, it has the idea of King, the one ruling over the Jews. And so the Jews are receiving the action in the objective genitive. So they shouted back, "Crucify him." But again, the adversative, to again continue to point out even the distinctions between Pilate's thinking and their thinking. They is actually just the definite article. This looks like this, ho, in the Greek. So it functions as a pronoun. Mark's done that pretty regularly throughout this book. They, again, Or once more, when they haven't translated this in the New American Standard, but you've got this adverb Pauline here again. They once more shouted, cried out, screamed, shouted. Krazo is the verb. And the emphasis of the verb krazo is, the verb krazo is kind of like our word croak. Not in die sense, but in the noise aspect. And frogs make a particularly, some people like it, a lot of people find it obnoxious. They find that the sound frogs make to be grating. Well, this verb krazo focuses on the sound, the sort of grating, strident sound that's produced as opposed to the words they're saying. They're not as much on that as they are on the noise these people are making. So they're strident. They're loud. So they shouted back, essentially. Shouted again or shouted back. That's how they translated Pauline here. They shouted again, or responded, we might say, crucify him is stauro. This word means S-T-A-U-R-O-O. This word means a stake, to stake him, literally, to impale him. Again, crucifixion was not developed by the Romans. It was developed by the Phoenicians, but it was a very brutal form, the most brutal form of torturous death that's ever been devised by man, because it could last so long. And again, leading up to the crucifixion, you had the factor of the scourging and other things that would go into this. But it was not unheard of for people to last up to a week on the cross. If you can imagine that kind of agony for a week, if you survive it even, you know. And sometimes they would give them water to help them last longer so they could enjoy the spectacle and let them suffer more. Now, this is pretty cruel. This is the human race right here. The cross tells you what the human race is really like. For all the facade of good that we plaster across things. And people try to do good things. I was watching the other day and they had this deal about, I don't know, some sports group or something. And they run around and they grant wishes to these poor terminal kids. They ought to grant them the gospel. That would be a wish you could grant. Hey, you want to know how to get to heaven? You're facing death. No, let's take them to a baseball game. How's that help? You're going to die. Oh, well, they're fulfilling their wish. Right, and then they're going to die and go to hell. Well, that's great. This is just a facade of goodness. It's not really goodness if you think about what they're doing. And it all sounds good. It's all emotional and oh, lovey-dovey and warm fuzzies. But guess what? It's not very kind. They're facing death. How about we get them the gospel? That'd be nice. If they reject it, then that's on them. So crucify him, stake him, impale him. But Pilate said to him, why? What evil has he done? But they shouted all the more, crucify him. Him is autos, the genitive there, him, Jesus. But, again, the back and forth here with the does. But Pilate was saying, kept on saying. See, Pilate tries to reason with people that can't be reasoned with. I've made that mistake. We all probably have. But, you know, that's the nature of the beast. Some people cannot be reasoned with. They're implacable. They are absolutely incorrigible. And you can try to reason with them until you're blue in the face. You can be as kind to them and as nice to them as you want. You can give them the truth in every way, shape, form, or fashion. You can do right by them. And guess what? You're not going to change them. And these people are like that. He kept on saying to them, to the crowd, those shouting, for what? Here it's not even actually translated, but you got a conjunction gar that's actually asked here as a form of clarification. Normally it introduces a causal explanation or an explanatory clause or a causal clause. But here he's asking for an explanation. Why? What? Interrogative adjective tis. What has he done? What crime? In other words, what you got here in the Greek, you got tis with the verb poieo, to do, and then kakos, which means bad or evil, depending upon the context. What evil has he done? What crime has he committed would be how we would loosely translate this without doing any injustice to the Greek. This is what Pilate's asking them. What crime has he committed? Tell me what crime he's committed. I'll condemn him, but I've got to have a breach of law here. And so Pilate's following good legal justice. It's what he should be doing. He's a judge. But, again, aversative duh to show you the contrast. But they, again, the definite article here acting as a pronoun. But they shouted, screened again, crucify him all the more. They shouted all the more. The crazo is the verb, same one we had before. And then you've got this adverb perisos. P-E-R-R-I-S-O-S. Four times this refers to that which is abundant. That which is beyond what is necessary. So this is a crowd gone sort of nuts. They're nuts already to start with, and this isn't helping. They shouted all the more, or all the more abundantly, or loudly, or vehemently, if you want to take it as a sort. It is adverbial. It is an adverb here. But they shouted all the more, stake him. Crucify him. It's just two words in the Greek. Aorist, active, imperative. This is a command. This is the will of the crowd. Kill Jesus. We don't care whether he's innocent or not. Kill him. We are in this bloodthirsty rage, and we want to see a good crucifixion this morning. And here's the guy we want to see dead. And of course, the chief priests are working behind the scenes, but the crowds obviously on their own demonstrate very little loyalty to Jesus at all. But again, given the context, he's from Galilee. Barabbas is probably from Judea. Barabbas is a freedom fighter. Jesus won't stand up against Rome. Barabbas hates paying taxes. Jesus advocates that you should pay your taxes. So you can see where you start comparing him, and he doesn't come across, Jesus does not, come across very well on the patriotism front. He looks like he's not a patriot compared to Barabbas. And so they want, this is their will. Well, point one here, there are a couple of textual issues found in verse 12. But as is often the case, they do not affect the interpretation of the verse. Two, the first is the presence of the verb fellow, to will or want or wish, which is found in the question Pilate asked the Jews. While many manuscripts omit the verb or add the conjunction hina, the presence of the verb here is consistent with Mark's style. And the second textual matter is found in the phrase, the one you call. Whom you call is actually what you've got there in the New American Standard. Whom you call, which is omitted by many witnesses and should probably be placed in brackets to indicate its uncertainty. But, again, doesn't materially affect anything. They're all using the same language, King of the Jews. This has been tossed around by the chief priests. It's been used by Pilate. It's been used by Herod. And it would not be unusual at all to hear it among the crowd, because they've been privy to a lot of this. And again, I think the crowd is growing as we go, because as you get later into the day, into the morning, more people are out, more people are about. The noise, and also they also know that Pilate's in the habit of pardoning somebody. So for those who live in Jerusalem and those environs, Judea, that would be a big deal for them. Before, Pilate has already identified Jesus as the King of the Jews in verse 9. So attributing this title to the Jews would not be out of place, since they were the first ones that used the title. The chief priest brought that charge against him to Pilate. 5, if the phrase, the one you call, is original, and evidence would suggest that it is difficult to know exactly how Pilate means it. Some have suggested that he's being sarcastic and insulting the Jews by using the title. Oh, this is the one you call the King of the Jews, you idiots. I don't think he's the King of the Jews. You call him King of the Jews. And so Pilate would be, looking down his nose at him while he said it. B, others see it as an attempt to appeal to them, which I think is more likely, hoping that they would respond to it and ask for Jesus' release. But this assumes Jesus has some supporters in the crowd, which I don't think he does. I mean, there's some people there. We know that there were people that followed, women that followed, including his mother. Now, how Mary got wind of all of this and what happened, we don't know. But she's there at the cross. We can place her there. Now, was she here for the trial phase of this, or did she find out about it after it was over? We're not really told. We do know, if you look in the Gospel of Luke, that as they're making the death march, and what did Jesus told his disciples? If you want to be my disciples, this is a death march. Well, he's going to make a literal death march right in front of them. I mean, not that they're there to see it, but he does. And so there, as they go out, in verse 27 and following him in Luke 23, verse 27, and following him was a large crowd of the people. and of women who were mourning and lamenting him. Now, we don't know, we don't know that Mary's in among that group. We're just not told. But we're told that there's a significant amount of people once this is all said and done. But now we're approaching 9 in the morning. This has been a raucous noise out here now at the Bema seat, probably for some time. I mean, it's been back and forth because he sent him off to Herod. But as you get closer to the end of this, it gets louder and louder and louder. And so more and more people are going to be attracted to this. Well, by the time more and more people are getting there, well, the situation's basically done. Jesus' fate is sealed. Pilate's going to have no choice for a couple of reasons. All of them wrong, but he's going to have no choice. One of his biggest hurdles, of course, was Jesus wouldn't defend himself. And as a judge, you've got to offer a defense. I've got to hear something, And Jesus offered a defense in that my kingdom's not of this world and I came to bear witness to the truth. Well, Pilate wasn't interested in either of those things. Again, you may have a metaphysical kingdom that exists somewhere outside the time-space continuum. I'm not going to debate that with you. Well, why would you? How could you? We talk about heaven and all of that as a place that's outside the time-space continuum. That it exists beyond the boundaries of finite space. See, space itself is finite. It appears infinite from our perspective. But there's an end to space. It's finite. When God spoke all this into existence, from what we can tell physically, it appears that space is expanding, which tells you that it's finite. If it were infinite, it couldn't expand. That's just common sense. If it were already infinite, you couldn't get any bigger than infinite. So contrary to the little kid's game, infinity plus one, well, you can't do that. There is no infinity plus one. So space is finite, and the fact that it's expanding would tell us that it's finite. It has to be finite if it's still expanding. Well, the fact is God exists, his kingdom exists, and now it exists within the time-space continuum. The kingdom exists now within his subjects, at whatever level it exists, and that varies from subject to subject in the kingdom. Depending upon how oriented they are as subjects, depending upon how oriented they are to the king and how many principles of the truth they apply and all that. But we would say the kingdom of heaven itself, the place where God resides, is outside the boundaries of time, space. And time doesn't seem to be an issue with God, as we're going to see. Because all the things that happen, like what happens on the cross, clearly, one might make the argument, How can you say that billions and billions and billions of sins are imputed into the body of Jesus for 3 hours and all of them are judged? How can that happen? Well, clearly there's more going on there than we might talk about in terms of just finite sins. They are being imputed to his body and being judged. But for Jesus, how long did each second last? How long would a second last for you on the cross? And pretend we can't even put ourselves in his place because we've never been totally obedient. We've never been completely righteous. So we have no idea what separation from the Father would be like for one who had never experienced it at all. And so for Jesus, essentially, my view is that each second was an eternity. And Jesus is suffering under this with no proof that it's ever going to stop. And so as he suffers there, again, many things, metaphysical things are going on. There's demonic activity going on. No doubt there was some angelic activity. Who knows? Maybe all the elect angels were just stopped and watching. We're not told what all was going on. But certainly the battle for eternity and the battle for men's souls is fought out there in a space of 3 hours. In which, if that doesn't happen, there is no salvation. And we're going to get into a lot of the reasoning behind that. We'll see doctrines that we'll get into this. We'll get many of these doctrines related to soteriology in Romans. But the doctrine of propitiation is critical to all of this. Everybody who sinned has violated God's righteousness. This does two things. Number one, it pisses God off. Violations of God's righteousness make him angry. Using language of anthropopathism, attributing emotions to God. And secondarily, it makes you guilty. So now you got two things to deal with. God's righteousness, which you've offended, and the guilt which you naturally incur because you have broken God's law. And so when all of this happens, so you've got the anger of God directed at sin, and yet he directs it at his son when it was due to us. This is what we should have got. What he goes through on the cross is what was coming to us, every one of us. And so this all gets into issues of righteousness. Well, the doctrine of propitiation is critical to all of this, because this addresses the matter of God's righteousness being satisfied. And along with propitiation, you have another doctrine, a sister doctrine, we might say, called expiation. And so essentially one of the things they did in the Roman Empire when they were dealing with matters of criminal activity was if you had a certificate of debt against you, let's say you were thrown into prison for non-payment of debt, and that could happen. They still had things like debtors' prisons for one time throughout history. No, we don't really have them now. But you could be incarcerated because of debt. You see that in one of those parables where this guy owes the king $2 billion. And then the king forgives him, wipes out his debt. And then he goes out and finds somebody that owed him 50 bucks and chokes him. Chokes him out. Well, what the Romans would do is they would have a certificate of debt. They would write out your particular crimes, what you owed on this debt. They'd stick it on the prison door. And so this certificate of debt, Paul's going to use this in one of his books, and he says he took this certificate of debt, our certificate of debt, that had all of our debts on it, and he nailed it to the cross, and Jesus paid it. And so therefore, you have a real simple choice in life, not very hard, really. Frankly, and that is, Jesus took your place, took all the sins that were coming to you. Do you want to take his place and take all the blessings coming to him? Good trade. Real good trade. And that's what the cross is all about, essentially, in short. Well, here, Jesus is, Pilate's hoping Jesus has some supporters out here. Well, he doesn't, to speak of. If he does, they're few and far between. And many of them may have been women, even if they were there. And they would have still been, I believe, in the vast, vast minority. Well, 6, Mark uses the adverb pollen once more again, twice in verses 12 and 13, which emphasizes the fact that there was a significant repetition of events during this phase of Jesus' trial. Again, as we saw in John's account, there's a lot of back and forth between Pilate and the crowd. Pilate going inside, Pilate outside. Pilate inside, Pilate outside. Pilate inside, Pilate outside. And during these outside times, he's interacting with these people. And so this adverb pollen, even though Mark doesn't record all that, he tells you there's been some significant repetition here of things that have gone on. So 7, although some think the indirect object, to them, refers to the priest, when Pilate said to them, that they were the immediate subjects of verse 11. But it is evident that Pilate is responding to the crowd, which clearly contains the religious leaders. They're now a subset of the bigger group, the crowd. So 8, John's account would indicate that before Pilate made the final decision to proceed with the crucifixion, that he had delivered Jesus to the Roman soldiers. But Mark's version seems to indicate that Pilate never interacted with Jesus or the Jews after this point. And 9, there is no doubt that John's account is emphasizing that Pilate made every attempt to release Jesus. And Mark's account focuses less on that and more on the guilt of the religious leaders and the crowd. And that's just a difference of an emphasis. Both things are going on. Pilate's making efforts to try to get out of this. But Mark focuses on the efforts that the chief priests and the crowd were making to get Jesus crucified. That's where his focus is. But again, both are happening. 10, as he has done consistently throughout this book, Mark uses the weak adversative conjunction duh at the beginning of verse 13 to point out the contrast between two conflicting views. And 11, although Pilate certainly hopes to get some help from the crowd and to extricate himself from what had become a very difficult and uncomfortable situation, their response forces him to recognize that such will not be the case. 12, the crowd has become quite energized by this point and simply attempts to shout Pilate down with demands for a crucifixion. They were going, as it was to this point, they're going to make themselves heard at all costs. If they have to shout down the Roman governor, that's no problem for them. This they believe to be fine. So verse 14 here is also introduced with the adversative conjunction. To continue the emphasis on the conflicting opinions between Pilate and the crowd about what should be done with Jesus. Pilate clearly thinks he should be let go. And by this time, although we're not told, by this time he's already had Jesus scourged. Mark kind of recurs the scourging. And actually he doesn't even record it. In fact, Mark skips over the scourging, but John does point out that Pilate's already had Jesus scourged by this point, because if you remember, one of Pilate's, he hoped one of his outs was to let Jesus get away with just a beating. You know, we'll just give you a good beating, a good talking to, young man. Don't you run around and do this stuff no more. And that, you know, that's what he hoped would happen. That didn't work. He tried sending him off to Herod. That didn't work. Now he wants to release him again. That's not going to work. So these people are just insistent upon blood. And that's it. Well, 14, on this occasion, Pilate asked them a question designed to appeal to their reason and sense of justice. You would like to think morons had a sense of justice, but they don't. You would like to think that the negative really care about what's correct and right and true and fair. They don't. They're not interested in that. Whatever they're interested in, it isn't those things. And this comes across loud and clear in this incident, that they're not interested in justice. They care less about justice. They want to get Barabbas freed, and they want Jesus gone. And of course, the ringleaders, the chief priests, are the ringleaders in all this, as we know. So they're not interested in that. So I'll try to appeal to their better nature. They don't have one at this point. But this is the nature of mob mentality, is it not? Once a mob gets going, it almost develops a will of its own that has no regard for anything. You see this regularly. I mean, you watch these mobs around the world, say in the Egyptian unrest and all of that. And they don't have any sense till somebody starts firing live ammunition at them. Then suddenly, they don't want a mob riot anymore. They want to run the opposite direction. Smart move. They start firing live ammo at you. You better get out of there. And so, but you see these mobs and the way they operate, and there's no sense to it. You shouldn't even be looking for sense. Pilate's trying to appeal to a sense of decency that the crowd doesn't even have right now. And that's just sad, but it's true. Well, 15, in fact, the Greek of verse 14, which employs the imperfect of the verb lego, indicates that Pilate asked the crowd this question multiple times during his exchanges with them. He keeps asking him the same question over and over again. What should I do with Jesus? Oh, this is the question everybody's going to answer in human history. What shall I do with Jesus? And you're either going to deal with him now or you're going to deal with him in judgment. That's your two choices. That's all there is. You'll either deal with Jesus now on his terms in grace, or you'll deal with him on his terms in judgment. I think I'd rather have grace. I'd like to skip the judgment and go directly to grace for 1,000 Alex. Let's skip judgment. We'll just skip that category and go to grace. And so you have options. You know, do I orient to God now when it's free and it's easy and it's simple? Or do I wait until he forces my hand? Well, those are your choices. I would suggest orienting to God now. Solomon said, remember your creator in the days of your youth. In other words, do it while you're young. Get oriented to God while you're young. Because there are great blessings and benefits to being oriented to God. Who knows what God can do for people? They have no idea. People always sell God short. God is omnipotent. He has all power. He can do anything he wants. He can bless you with some of the greatest stuff in the world you can even imagine. Or he can jam you. Which way do you want to go? You got a choice. Humble yourself under the mighty hand of God and wait and see what God will do for you. Or lunge and do it your way. Well, Sinatra did it his way. And that's where a lot of believers end up going. Well, don't go that route. Well, 16, while the reader is never told how many times Pilate attempted to reason with the crowd, Luke indicates that he asked them on at least three distinct occasions what it was that Jesus had done that would demand the death penalty. Luke 23:22 there. Finally, he said to them the third time, why? What crime has this man committed? What evil has he done would be tantamount to our modern vernacular. What crime has he committed? You want a death penalty. I need a legitimate crime. I can't just pass a death penalty on everybody. I mean, what kind of judge would that be? That would be a judge that didn't have any sense at all. Well, 17, the question, what evil has he done, is to be understood in terms of known laws. It was a question that asked for a response about what actual laws Jesus had broken. So 18, he knew that their charge had only been that Jesus claimed to be king of the Jews. But it is evident that Pilate was not at all convinced that Jesus was any type of revolutionary leader. And he was not. Jesus was not any type of revolutionary. We know that. I think the people knew that. Pilate knew that. This is a world gone mad. And we see the human race for what it really is, the insanity that rules in these people. And sadly, everybody might say, well, if we were there, we would have done difference. Who knows? You'd like to hope so, wouldn't you? But that was exactly, isn't that what the Jews said to Jesus? He said, oh, you decorate the prophets' tombs and all that. And you say, if we'd have been there, we wouldn't have been a partaker in that. And he said, yet his very thing testifies against you that you would have. So, this is the insanity of the human race, and this is what Jesus is up against. 19, he continuously sought to appeal to any sense of logic, reason, and fair play that might have existed among the assembled mob. However, he found out that little or none of those things were present on this occasion. And 20, although it is difficult to establish a precise order of events, it would seem that the unique events recorded by John had occurred by this point in Mark. And now John records in chapter 19, verses 1 through 15, have occurred by the point where we are in Mark now. But this hasn't all been spelled out by Mark. Mark's, again, his account's very abbreviated. He gets right to the point and moves on. But that's been the nature of Mark's style in writing. So then Pilate took Jesus and had him scourged. And the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head and put a purple robe on him. And they began to come up to him and say, "Hail, King of the Jews," and gave him slaps to the face. So then Pilate came out again. See, he was hoping this would do it, the scourging. He was hoping this would do it. And tries to appeal to them with, "Hey, I've beaten the guy. He's learned his lesson. And now I'm going to turn him loose." And he comes out wearing this robe. And he brings him out, as he says in verse 4, "I bring him out so that you may know I find no guilt in him." Not guilty. Again, repeatedly, Pilate tells him he's not guilty, not guilty, not guilty, not guilty. Then Jesus came out wearing the crown of robes and the purple, the crown of thorns rather, and purple robe. And Pilate said, "Behold the man." And when they saw him, they all started screaming, "Crucify." And then when Pilate heard this statement in verse 8, he was even more afraid. And he entered into the praetorium again and said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" Oh, good question. Where are you from? And he's already pronounced him, "Behold the man." He thinks he's nothing more than human. Pilate, he's no better off or worse off than even the disciples were. They all thought he was just a human being. And Jesus gave him no answer. And Pilate said to him, "Do you not speak to me?" And this is where he says, "I have authority to release you and I have authority to crucify you." And Jesus said, "You would have no authority over me unless it had been given you from above." Delegated authority comes from God alone. God's the only one that possesses authority as a part of his essence. Every other authority is delegated, and every other authority better remember that. From the pastor teacher, who's the ranking spiritual authority in the church age, to the deacons, to husbands, to bosses, all throughout history. Parents, you better recognize I'm a delegated authority. I'm in charge because God's put me in charge. Now that means something. That means two things. Number one, you better not abuse that authority. But on the other hand, number two, you better exercise it properly and not adopt this sort of laissez-faire approach to it. Where, oh, I'm just not going to do anything even though I'm in charge. So that's wrong. That's equally as wrong as abusive authority. Of not doing anything when you should. Here's Pilate. He's got authority. Exercise it. He won't do it. He does not exercise his authority properly, and that comes across loud and clear in all of this. "But for this reason, he who delivered me to you has the greater sins." And then finally, as we're going to see, he brings him out, and they throw this deal about Caesar on him, and he's like, okay, now they're threatening my political career. And I've tried reasoning with them. They're unreasonable. They're implacable. They're bitter. They're hatred. They're murderous. They're all these things. They're hateful. And so Pilate finally just throws up his hands, in a sense. So having an understanding of the additional facts enables the reader to see why Pilate continues to engage the crowd, which had obviously made its will known. And he has continued his attempts to release Jesus. B, it is likely that the scourging recorded in the first three verses of 19 was Pilate's attempt to do what Luke indicates that he had offered to do. I will beat him and let him go. But he'd offered to do that. Well, he actually follows through with that. But again, you have to kind of put this together from all the accounts that he follows through with this and then beats Jesus, has him scourged, beaten severely, in fact. Following that scourging and abuse, Pilate brings Jesus out for the third time, according to John's account, and pronounces him to be innocent. Indeed, with the continued insistence of the crowd to crucify Jesus, Pilate makes it plain that he knows that this is murder. And he announces he will have no part in it. In 19:6, he says that. He said, "You take him yourselves and you crucify him. I'm not having any part of this. I find no guilt in it. I'm not doing it. I won't sign the death sentence." And yet, finally, as we know, he will. He doesn't have the backbone to make it stick. The crowd continues to reject Pilate's attempts to do the right thing and informs him that under their religious law, Jesus was worthy of death. F, their statement in verse 7 indicates that Jesus' assertions about his identity had been investigated fully. And his suggestion that he was the Son of God was a lie. And G, some have attempted to soften the phrase Son of God because it's anarthrous. In other words, it lacks the definite article in verse 7. They suggest that since it lacked the article before both nouns, that it is not intended to mean a claim to deity. But H, however, precisely the opposite is true, and the anarchist phrase, Son of God, had really only been attributed to Augustus Caesar at this time under Roman situation. They were the only, Augustus Caesar was the only one whom they had called Son of God. And as the longer Rome ruled and the more they got into this, the more the rulers began to assume titles of deity as a savior of the world and that kind of thing. The very titles that are true of Jesus, you know, these human rulers began to assume. And of course, this is why many believers suffered death and martyrdom, because they would not attribute these titles to human rulers. They would not say, "You're the Son of God," as the same way Jesus is. "You are not the Savior of the world in the way Jesus was." And so they rejected all this. Well, many of them paid the price for it. They paid the price for their lives. But here, this title would be viewed as one that suggested equality to or being greater than Caesar. And when Pilate hears the phrase Son of God, he becomes quite fearful. Now, John indicates that Pilate had already been afraid of where this was headed. I mean, he's already heard that message from his wife. That's got to spook him. What's all this about now? And he already knew Jesus was innocent before that. And now here, he starts really dealing with this matter of, is he the Son of God? Which was likely a heightened response based on the startling information his wife had just sent him. And Jay, he then takes Jesus back into his residence and questions him about his place of origin. And that's in verse 9. Where are you from? And at this point, Jesus knows his fate. He has answered any pertinent questions and knows that Pilate understands that he is innocent. So he doesn't respond with any further information. What more could he say? Really? In some cases, people have said, well, Jesus could have done more to defend himself. Really, what more could he have done? Was Pilate going to listen? Were these people going to listen? It didn't matter. Him saying anything or nothing really didn't matter. Because they all knew what was going on. Everybody there knew what was going on. This was a court where that being railroaded by the Jews to kill an innocent man. Everybody knew what was happening. And God's not very pleased when innocent people get killed. He's even less pleased when that innocent person is absolutely righteous and it's his son. That really offends him, as we're going to see. So everybody, again, knows what's going on. There's no point in saying anything more. It's all been said. Pilate knows the information. This elicits an irritated response from Pilate, in which he informs Jesus that his destiny is in Pilate's hands and that he had damn well better respond. I mean, that's the force of this. He's trying to let him know, you better be careful here, buddy. Really? Here's another irony. Who better be careful in this context? Is Jesus judging Pilate, or is it the other way around? That's the other way around. Pilate thinks he's judging Jesus. But Pilate's overblown sense of his own importance does elicit a response from Jesus, in which he addressed several issues and puts Pilate in his place. And Jesus tells Pilate that all authority comes from heaven. And Pilate is only in the position he's in because of the will of God. Now, did Pilate understand or believe this? No, not probably not. But is it true? Yes. All authorities are there at God's will, either under his directive will or his permissive will. But they're there. So this gets into a matter of authority and how we're to deal with it. Well, if all authority is from God, and God's got him there, I can tell you that the correct response is orient to it. If it's wrong, if it's over the top, you orient to it and you put it in God's hands and you pray about it. And that's easier, way easier said than done. Anybody that suffered under an abusive authority or any of that, it's way easier to say, well, you just pray about it and you leave it with God and you see what God can do. But how many people have ever tried it? Of just leaving it with God and see what God will do. Faith rested. Okay, God, you've got me here. You know my situation. And then this is a good time to read a lot of those Psalms, where you read Psalms and you see David suffering under various things. And sometimes deserved, sometimes undeserved. But he's suffering under them, but he always takes his case to God. He makes his case with God, but he leaves it with God. He says, you know, these people are abusing me. You know, please stop them. Break the arms of the wicked, etc., etc. But he doesn't go out and try to deliver himself. He prays about it and he leaves it with God. That's the test. But see, Jesus has already done this. He's left it with God there. This was all settled for him back in the garden. He's oriented to God's will. Okay, I've got to drink this cup. And this cup isn't going to be a fun. This is not a fun cup. That's all you can do, though. Again, Pilate is only where he is. If God didn't want Pilate there, somebody else would have been there. But God, in his eternal plan, this is where he knew everything would be. And nothing, of course, shocks God. This is what gets believers into trouble. I think, you know, our problem is we get shocked. We get surprised by developments. God never does. He always saw it coming. So he's not shocked. And so, you know, we've all done it. We've all made mistakes, got ourselves into situations, and then we're shocked at the outcome of it. And you think, well, God was never shocked. He knew. He knew what we were going to do before we did it. He knows your thinking while you're thinking it now. He knows what you're going to be thinking 10 seconds from now, 10 years from now. He knows exactly all of it. And so from his perspective, he knows what's here. And he just watches to see, well, who will orient to me and commit their cause to me? Because that's the one I'm going to vindicate. In the end, whether you get your vindication in time, irrelevant. If you get the vindication at the bema seat, you get to be one of those few that hears, well done. Then it's going to mean something. Then we're going to find out what vindication can really be about. The praise and the glory and the honor that comes to those who humble themselves under God's plan. Human arrogance, you figure you got it all figured out, you know it all, that's okay. God's not impressed. He's seen it 100,000 times before. There's nothing new under the sun. You think God hadn't seen every expression of human arrogance already? Some people think, oh, well, I'm really something. Oh, God's seen it before. He's seen it all before. He's not impressed. People think they're really smart. You know, and you may have a really high IQ, and if you do, good for you, but it works against you sometimes. That's the bad thing about high IQ. Because it tends towards arrogance in the people that have it. I love that show, Big Bang Theory. Sheldon's the most arrogant so-and-so I've ever seen in my life. Well, second maybe. But he's up there. He's up there. And he has he's got this overblown sense of his own importance. Oh, it's funny on TV till you run into people like him. Then it's not as funny. But he's got this overblown sense of his importance and his place in the universe. And of course, he's anti-God. He doesn't believe in God or any of this stuff. So, you know. But there are some very, very smart people out there. And they're going to die and go to hell because they're too smart to believe in Jesus. Well, That's too bad, but that's the way it is. Well, Pilate thinks he's really something, and Jesus tells him, no, you're not. You're only here because of the will of God, dude. And I know it, and you better know it. Well, however, just because a person is in a particular position of authority by God's design, it does not place any responsibility for their actions on God. And it certainly does not absolve them of the responsibility for their personal actions. See, free will plays out in all of this. God may allow somebody to be in a position of authority, whether it's a pastor, a deacon, a governmental leader, whatever, a teacher. But every person's going to answer for their own actions in their position, how they handled that position, and what they did. Well, thus Jesus rightly views Pilate as God's agent. Nevertheless, it is apparent that Jesus recognized who is the actual authority in this manner and calmly accepts what that authority determines. There's a lot of lessons there, aren't there? Oh, do we calmly accept what our authorities determine, or do we bow up against it? You're wrong! You know, we've all done it, I'm sure. I've done it. Well, Jesus does acknowledge that Pilate does have some guilt in regard to the disposition of his case, which is clearly implied by the fact that others have greater sin and guilt. And he tells him that. The one who delivered me, in verse 11, to you, has the greater sin. Wait a minute, greater, that means I've got sin, though. And in this context, we would translate sin as culpability. The one who delivered you is more culpable. What you do with me makes you culpable. You've got your own level of culpability in this. You've got the facts of the case, Pilate. You know I'm innocent. You know these Jews are nuts. You know that I should be set free. You've already beaten me for no reason. And Jesus knows all this, and Pilate knows all this. But so he basically tells him, well, they're more culpable, but any common sense person would be thinking, well, that means I'm culpable too. Just because they're more culpable doesn't get me off the hook. Well, although the murderous Jews are far more guilty when it comes to Jesus Christ and shares in that guilt, Pilate shares in that guilt, rather, since he knows the right thing to do and doesn't do it. That's where the guilt lies. When you know the right thing to do and you won't do it, that makes you guilty before God. He who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin. And this becomes a sin. To him it's a violation in that sense. And as he knows that Jesus Christ is guilty of all the charges, or pardon, innocent, rather, of all the charges, that really changes the sentence. He's innocent of all the charges that they had leveled against him, but does not release him as justice demanded that he should. And so, as you see, Pilate has every opportunity. The Lord gives him every opportunity to back out of this, to get out of it. God gave him every motive. That deal from his wife, he knows they're doing this out of envy. Pilate knows all this, and yet he still won't do what's right. And that's the danger of having knowledge. Knowledge makes us culpable. So again, in one sense, you're better off not learning any doctrine. Because the more doctrine you know, the more God's going to hold your feet to the fire. But, of course, then again, doctrine provides happiness and health, stability. Bible doctrine is healing to the bones. All these types of things. Well, there's some really great benefits from doctrine. And let's not even get into the eternal possibilities of what doctrine can provide for those that orient to God. Because here now, when we get into the matter of surpassing grace rewards and eternal rewards, God has what can the essence of the Almighty God crank up for somebody he's pleased with. Well, man, I'd really like to have a boat or a big house or this or that. Think of any detail you could want. I'd like to have a huge diamond. I'd like to have whatever. Whatever trips your trigger. $100,000 car. You know. I'd like to be able to ride in the rocket, go to the space station, any of that. Think of all the things that you might like to do, places you'd like to see, things you'd like to have, and then ask yourself, what can God do outside of the time-space continuum for people that please Him, that have pleased Him, that have laid their lives down for Him, and lived this out? And in some cases, it's easier to die for God than it is to live for Him. So a lot of people, you know, well, yeah, I'd die for you, Lord. Well, that was Peter, wasn't it? I'd die for you, Lord. I know these other idiots won't, but I will. And so Peter's arrogant, and he manifests that. And he looks down on them. Well, guess what? It's a matter of living for the Lord that makes the difference. And so if you'll humble yourself under the mighty hand of God, what can he do? God can pull things together you couldn't even begin to fathom. And so, when you get into the eternal aspects of this, well, there's a lot to be offered. Okay, well, our time is gone. We're going to have to stop there. So we will continue on here with this on Tuesday. Just a reminder also, there's no class Thursday night this week. So adjust your schedule accordingly. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your plan. May God, the Holy Spirit, sanctify this information to our souls in Christ's name. Amen.